This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Jyoti Kabui is a farmer and a chef. He moved to America to attend college years ago, but his native Kenya is never far from his mind, especially when he's around food, which is most of the time. Kabui maintains a vegetable garden in Apex, North Carolina, and he just bought a plot of land in North Durham. He and a small army of volunteers are currently working to get the land ready for a community garden. It will also serve as the main headquarters for Organics and Sound, the sustainable food catering company Kabui started last year. He wants to use the garden and the profits from Organics and Sound to raise awareness about the benefits of eating local and growing your own food. And Kabui plans to spread some of those same lessons back home in Kenya. Chef Kabui is my guest this hour on The State of Things. Welcome to the show. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much, my friend.
You started farming at a young age. You're working alongside your mother in the coffee fields of Central Province. What did you learn about agriculture from that experience?
Number one, the beauty of soil and the calming effect of soil, and probably the most important lesson and message I always carry around, that food is the most intimate thing in your life. And the second lesson, the most probably equally important, is that food is the most political thing you ever touch in your life.
Now, you didn't have a sense of it being political when you were a little boy.
No. But actually, that's the defining relationship with my mother about the discussion of why we were growing coffee that my mother claimed she was losing money on, and she could not approve it. So I started having a very important political science class with my mother. I said, why is our land? How come we can't approve the coffee that's losing money? She said, well, that's illegal. I said, how is it illegal? It's our farm. You say we own the farm. If it's ours, we can't. So that started a discussion that probably led me to interest in understanding the more global food system, how it's structured, and that kind of stuff.
I love it. The first political science conversation, your first political science class was with your mother in the field.
Yes.
And so you did own the farm. This was your farm.
Yes, it was our farm. 40% of the land was occupied by coffee, but we grew. We had more than 20 fruits along, so I ate very well in some ways, other than the political issues that of the food. But I knew we could eat better. I knew other people are not eating well, so it didn't take me long to find out that there was something terribly wrong with the food. We were using chemicals that I did not understand. I was suspicious of them because soon after. In a few years, I could tell people were having diseases they didn't have before. Hmm. Even my mother, there were no names for it, so I knew it was not native to our culture. So I started being kind of suspicious of the way we were heading. And I was terribly concerned about the future. Okay, these things are not good now, but what's the long-term impact of using chemicals to grow food?
So while your mother is working in the fields, what's your father doing?
My father worked in the city. He had a restaurant. Him and some of his friends who were involved in the struggle for liberation formed a partnership, a partnership that actually spanned into maybe three or four, I think maybe at some point five businesses. So my father only came home on the weekend. So that was another issue that I wasn't very comfortable with because I really liked my father. So
what was your relationship like? He was not home much.
Yeah, he was only home on the weekend. So that would also actually be the next step in my kind of trajectory, the food trajectory, because I liked my father a lot. He was a very, very nice man, probably one of the nicest guys I've ever met. Very patient, that kind of stuff. He's very knowledgeable about the history of my people. So he told me a lot of good stories and told me a lot. But I didn't see a lot of him, so I figured, how can I get close to him? So the only solution was for me to kind of feign sicknesses from time to time so that he can take me to the doctor in the city. And then finally, he figured what I was doing, so he transferred me to the city, so I started living in the city.
And just between your mother's farm work, I guess, and your father owned a restaurant,
yes,
right?
He owned a restaurant, yes.
So again, here you are in the food business.
Yes.
More or less.
Yes, yes. Most of my cooking style, I use my cooking style, most of the lessons that I learned from my own father. Obviously, with also some of the helpful teachings that I've got from Pittsburgh Community College, their culinary program. But my father is my biggest influence in my food.
But tell us about this restaurant, because I understand that during the liberation struggle, it became more than just a place to grab a bite to eat.
Actually, that's the rebirth of the restaurant, the second one. They, my father initially owned a restaurant in the main section of the city, which was like a one-street city then during the colonial government.
And this is a city, so we're not talking
Nairobi.
About Nairobi.
Nairobi. Nairobi. Right. So he owned this restaurant. And the restaurant was a safe haven for the freedom fighters who are in the forest. So one time, one of the freedom fighters came to the city to buy a gun. And some bullets. Somebody had given a tip. Hey, we can sell. Somebody's selling bullets and guns. So anyway, so he came to the city, but he was spotted. So he was being followed. And so he knew the one place he could escape, he could try to get some help, was at my father's restaurant. So he walks straight through the entrance into the kitchen and tells the chef, "I'm being followed." So the chef gives him the chef coat and a hat and a basket to act like he's going to the market. But he left the bullets there. So when the people who are pursuing him, the British, they found the bullets, they held up the place, and in about 45 minutes, they hanged everybody who was working at the restaurant. So he lost the restaurant.
Wow.
So that's a new restaurant he opened up after. And he did 7 years in detention.
I was going to say, they don't just let you go after that.
No. So, you know, he ended up doing 7 years. So my food is also a form of activism. So I've always, my father refused to let the restaurant idea die, even if he had lost everything. So it was a big disaster in my family.
What was your sense of it? Did your father? What was your relationship with your father? He's in the movement. Now.
Yes,
this is an armed liberation struggle.
Yes.
Did he feel that you should be part of it? Did he talk to you about it?
I was born 5 years after the Kenyan gained independence, so I wasn't born. My brother, most of this stuff that I heard from my brother. So luckily or unluckily for me, I wasn't there.
These are stories about stories you heard growing up. But again, the sort of the politics of to what extent then, because this farm that you're farming now is in Kenya is now an independent country.
Yes.
Right. You can do what you want with the land. Why are we still tied up in a commodity that your mother can't make a profit of?
Sort of. When Kenya became independent in 1963, I don't think now, from a political science perspective, I can say Kenya was independent because economically it was not independent. It still assumed some debts from the colonial government. It was still tied to the IMF and the World Bank. Most of the land was still held by the British and former colonial, by the way, thanks to Thurgood Marshall, who helped design the constitution in a way that favored the people who were the actual Europeans who owned the land. So it was still a big struggle. It was actually not the liberation, but the beginning of liberation. So unfortunately for most of the Kenyans, they assumed, "Oh, we are free." No, it was actually now the beginning of or the next stage of liberation. So that's why the economic policies were still set to continue the old colonial policies to supply the mother country, which is Britain, with all their stuff we got. That's why we're growing coffee, because that's what they needed, not what we needed.
And so that's the genesis of this idea that that the continuation of the struggle, the real liberation, freedom and democracy, really comes with this essential commodity, food.
Yes. So the food was colonized as well.
Yeah.
So that's what I came to learn, you know, in my journey, that one of the reasons why we were growing food, we didn't have enough food since 1893, according to my study. Since 1893, Kenya has never gained food sovereignty or food security ever. That's the first time, when the railway was being built, Kenya's, my ethnic group, it was called the Agikuyu Nation. It had more food than anybody else in almost a 100-mile radius. So the people who are involved, the explorers, the Europeans, they bought a lot of food from my people, or from my nation, which is the First Nation. But after 2 years, after they sold the first food, a lot of food, which was my grandfather was living back then, there was a famine. And my grandfather didn't think it was a good idea to sell a lot of the food anyway. But so he fell out with a lot of people because, you know, but the point is, 2 years after that, there was a famine and a lot of people died. 40% of the population in my nation died because they sold all the food to the explorers. And so as a result, in fact, they called that the famine of Europe, because they sell the food. The people died because they sold their food to the Europeans. So since then, we've never had food security. So even then, now, even if, at least in my family, looking at my father losing the restaurant, the struggle for liberation of the people, losing all the airline, all that kind of stuff, is still tied now into this post-independence issue of food, that Kenyans were not dictating their own platform because they are still tied to this global system that dictates how food will be.
Tell us more about your grandfather and his resistance, the idea that we ought to be making deals with these Europeans.
Yeah, my grandfather, my whole family has been involved in activism. So my grandfather and his brother was a medicine man who's called Gatukume. Was his name. In fact, I have one dish. One of my dishes is named after him. So he was, my family is, you see, in Africa, we had very, very strict specialization where people are in certain specializations. So people who are maybe makers of ornaments, only made ornaments for the most part. That's mm-hmm. their specialization. There are people who are ironmongers, you know, are strictly ironmongers, and nobody from any other family could get into that guild. It was gilded. So anyway, so my father was in the area of, or at least from his lineage, was a person who was very thoughtful, people who are big thinkers, people always big ideas. So that's why he was. And my grandfather, after he heard now the Europeans, just to give you an example, are really getting a hold on to into the territory, he appointed my father and told three wives, say, I don't want this son, I'm letting it known to anybody, I don't want this son to do any other chores. His job is just to follow me and to learn all our ways, because I can see our ways and our wisdom is getting ready to be lost. So my father came to this country when I graduated and stayed 7 weeks with me. And for 7 weeks, he transferred a lot of the information that he had learned from his grandfather. So he was a big repository and big library of that. So
we will talk more about that, what you learned and how you will spread the word here in Durham and back home in Kenya with my guest, Chef Jothi Kabui, who is the founder of Organics and Sound, a sustainable food catering company. And you'll hear more on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Jothi Kabui, head of Organics and Sound, a catering venture that focuses on farm fresh food. Kabui's also preparing a plot of land for a community garden in North Durham as part of the Organics and Sound mission, and he takes some of what he's learned back to Kenya. So tell us about coming to the U.S. What was your plan in doing that?
Yes, so I came to the U.S. On some advice of one of the most learned guys in my community back home, who told me if I study political science, I'd be able to learn more about food. So I came to this country. I went to a historical black college, Lomonoy College, where I studied political science and minor in philosophy. So then that's when I learned food was really the most political thing. So after that, I went to the University of Memphis, where I studied medical anthropology in a wonderful program. In urban anthropology. So I'm interested in health issues and food issues. So after that, I was able to work with a company briefly that was based in Charlotte, North Carolina, and moved me down here. Probably the best thing I ever did, because I now got immersed in my life dream. I could see it coming true, because eventually I knew I wanted to do something around food. So I come here and there's all these activities going on around food. I went to the community college and took a class or two at community college in Pittsburgh, Central Carolina, and that's where I really, really got an opportunity to really actually have a vehicle to get to where I really needed to go. Because being engaged with that, I met a group. I had a very good friend of mine called Steve Harvey, who was putting a group together around food. He called us together. What's important, for no reason, just decide what's important to us. So that eventually allowed me to know the things that are going on around food in this area. So I took classes at different places, Virginia, with Will Allen, who did the Guardian of White House. But eventually, when the culinary program got opened up there,
The one in Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh, yes. Carl Thompson was very helpful in getting me an assistantship, because I mean, it's expensive, didn't have a lot of money. And so I took the class there, but I knew now I was all set. So I think now I had my circle was complete. I understand the political aspect of food. I understand about growing it. Now I want to know about cooking. So as soon as I finished, I did my internship at UNC Hospital Chapel Hill, and the chef there really wanted to hire me. In fact, it almost became a little unpleasant, because I really didn't want to take the job. I really wanted to do my own thing. So that's when I started Organics and Sounds.
So tell us about the culinary program, because it's not, you know, sort of how to make biscuits for the Marriott.
Yes. Right? No. Okay, so the culinary program, it was very, very special. I had a great instructor, Chef Kelly, who I also had the pleasure of doing a dinner with. The focus is how to work on natural food or how to use food for health or to how to cook with health in our mind, which is what I've always dreamed about. So that's the program has a very, very special program, actually very rare. They are actually the only one in this region that's doing anything close to that because, people cook food just to eat, how it tastes mm-hmm. good. Now people, we've suffered so much because of eating for taste. Now I think people are becoming a little bit more sane, more logical, say we need to eat with health in our mind.
So then tell us about Organics and Sounds. How does that come out of all of this?
So Organics and Sounds was actually a vehicle to carry a message that I've had, you know. And so it actually a combination of everything I've learned about my heritage. Nobody in my family just really does food full time. So, and my family has been farming for as far as maybe 300 years and that we can tell documented his history from my father. But now I could see that we're actually getting to the point where that almost breaking. So I really wanted, given the knowledge that I got from my father and my family, I wanted to keep it continuing. So I've formed Organics and Sounds because it does something that is activist. It's probably I always call it the greatest, boldest act of civil obedience, you know, to ourselves. So Organics, because organic, the very first food we ate, the healthiest food is got to be organic. But Sound, because food should be eaten around community. So there's music, that's the first level of sound. There's also second level of sound, in which is the conversation. You know, so in all my dinners, I always speak this conversation. And then there's also the third level of being in harmony with the planet. So you
put dinners together and go into people's houses. And
yes.
It's a kind of a catering service in a way.
Yes. Sort of, yeah. So we cook most of the food where we are. Right. So in our food, I always say we don't have to practice defensive eating. So we don't cook anything frozen. We don't cook anything canned. You know, we cook things that are fresh and live. Mm-hmm. And we cook even salad, down to salad dressing. We make the salad dressing. We make the sauces. Everything, we make it there. And then we do several. And we cooked everywhere. I had a dinner at a hair salon, Taji's Hair Salon, in Raleigh. And so we turned it into a restaurant on a Sunday when it's closed, form of appreciation, but also a teaching about how food is connected to hair. So I'm connecting food with everything, too.
You talked about, though, your family being in farming for a very long time, and yet your grandfather being very worried about losing what we knew.
Yes.
Now your mother's growing a commodity. She's growing a commodity crop, coffee.
Yes.
Do people in your province, Central Province, know how to farm? You talk about farm techniques, organic techniques.
Yes.
Who's still doing that? Do you have to go back and do people have to be retaught?
Oh, yeah. We're reconnecting. So that's another sound when we're reconnecting because my people are – it's interesting how the history turned out because there were Kenyans who were voting in this country in 2006 as the most modest cohort group in the U.S. as a group in 2006.
The most –
smartest people.
Oh, okay.
So in college, in American colleges.
Yeah.
So as a group, there's a cohort group that are smart. So Kenyans have, you've been in Kenya, we met there, but you know, so the Kenyans have a tendency to really jump on stuff. So if they see something, so people saw the Green Revolution and they thought it was the greatest thing that happened. So they're using chemicals. That's a modern way. Let's forget about the old. So organic food is not the most common food now.
So tell us about your trip, because I've known about your Organics and Sounds, and I've known about the dinners that you hold, but it wasn't until we were both in Nairobi earlier this year that we actually met up. What were you doing there?
Give you one saying, philosophical proverb in my country says, wealth is the remainder of your eating. So after you eat well, then you can be. So in other words, you can never be wealthy until you eat well. So I had this interesting notion of coming up with a commentary or a way of understanding food, the state of food in Kenya. Like you have the state of things here, right? So I wanted to know the state of things in Kenya. So I wanted to find a wealthy Kenyan. So because I'm not very satisfied, obviously, with the way we're eating. So I want to say this is a heritage we have of advice. The wealthiest Kenya will be the one that will be eating well. So that's one of the things I wanted to do. But also to understand the state of food in Kenya.
So you did that. And you do some teaching while you're there as well.
Yes, I did. I did some teaching. I did. I was on radio. I was on TV. I was on the newspaper. Mm-hmm. But spreading the message, making the call that, hey, we have to reconnect with our roots. We have to become more proactive in redefining our appetites and our taste buds because it's killing us.
All right, so that's your message, but how is it going over? We know in a region like this here in the Triangle, people are beginning to get this message, and it's a pretty easy sell. But in other parts of the country, not so much. What about in Kenya? The idea that you were going to do away with all these fertilizers and chemicals that have given us this abundance and go back to some primitive method that you're talking about, Kibui.
Actually, I call it divine primitive, if it's primitive, because it's divine. That's what we survived for so long. But it's not easy. The government just passed a bill allowing GMO food, which I even met with the chairman of the Agriculture and Livestock Committee, Honorable Mutudho, to have a discussion with this. And luckily, I had a city council Adler by Michelle Johnson from this area, from Carborough, with me. And so we had an interesting discussion. You know, try to impress upon him, you know, some of the thoughts or whatever. So there's some positive things in that people are very receptive, and having a so-called democratic government, then we can change, we can dictate. And my hope is in educating the people so that they can actually urge their elected officials to do something about it. But at the moment, things are not very positive.
Well, you know, and your central province is in a place called, geographically, the Rift Valley. There's a Rift Valley province, too. You don't want to confuse that. But the fact is, this is the cradle of humanity.
Yes.
The superabundance in this region is what nurtured human life into existence.
Yes.
That's how good it is.
Yes.
And yet, you're saying that it's being underutilized.
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely. And there's a lot of potentials of growing food in abundance in Kenya.
Will there have to be markets? Because most of the wealth right now is, most of the monetary wealth anyway, is in Nairobi. And I didn't get any sense there that, that people, they opened a Kentucky Fried Chicken, a KFC, in that little shopping plaza where we had dinner. It is the most popular restaurant. I mean, there are lines that go clear out to Riara Road, you know. So I didn't see any real appetite for organic food or the kind of movement, sort of in the popular mindset.
On my way here, or at least one of the meetings that I looked at before I came to the office was brainwashing. That our food is, when I say political, it's political because there's no reason why Kentucky Fried Chicken should be having long lines in Kenya. If people are interested, one, in jobs, in creating their own jobs, if they're interested in their own health, right? So there got to be an overarching force that's really compelling people to go and eat at the Kentucky Fried Chicken. Kentucky Fried Chicken is not doing very well here. It's not a very popular joint here. So even, you know, in America, so in Kenya. So that's a sign that we have a lot of work to do to socialize the people into understanding how eating affects their everyday life, their health, their society, their environment, all that kind of stuff.
Well, and in terms of jobs and sustainable economy, it's very attractive for people who are living in rural areas in Kenya, I think.
Yes.
To get a job at KFC in terms of just the weekly income must look great. Now, nobody tells them how much it costs to live in Nairobi. But what I'm saying is you're talking about sustainable jobs, ownership, where you actually invest and you have an equity return in your business.
Yes.
And again, isn't that a hard sell when somebody can offer you a salary that looks pretty high compared to what you're making in the Rift Valley or Central Province?
I don't know whether salaries are high. That's very relative because, as you said very well in your in your statement, you partly answered the question because somebody doesn't tell you how much it costs. So the cost of living is really going up, right, in Kenya. The cost of living and food has a lot to do with the cost of living because that's something that most people know. Most people know that you know, you have to live. That's something you can do with that.
Yeah, right.
So to have food that's expensive, but when you're out in the country, if you think about people, somebody living in the country, if they can even earn maybe half of what they are earning at the Kentucky Fried Chicken, they are living very well. And there are ways to do that because like organic eggs or like natural eggs, they are very hard to find in Kenya. I could not find them in the store. So grow them in the country, then bring it in. So it's a matter of socialization. It's got to be a brainwashing or something that we have to reconnect to so that we can actually start living life on a very, very present and real level, not just assumed or this illusion.
Tell me a little bit more about this graduation, because that was a time, and I think you mentioned it earlier, your father came for your graduation and stayed for 7 weeks. Now, that was probably about the most time you'd ever spent together, right?
Yes. So my father was very active politically, even after the independence. So there were always, I traveled to him numerous times. He was always doing fundraising for schools, hospitals, you know, political affairs. He was very active. So I never really actually got a lot of time to spend with my dad. But when I graduated, when I was in Memphis, I had a small business selling art. I was selling African art and doing framing. So I had enough money to buy him a ticket. And so he came, and he was very, very happy to have – this is the only time in my father's life where he could only do one thing, which is what I told him to do. All the time he told me where we're going, whatever. So I actually had – it was very, very special time. We spent a lot of time together. I didn't work. I just spent time with him, which was probably one of the biggest – learning I've done with my father throughout my life at one time, because we just spent 7 weeks together every day. I couldn't leave him anywhere. He couldn't leave me anywhere. So that was great.
What did you learn? Did you see him any differently in that time that you spent?
It probably helped me in my research that I've been doing, because I always say now I'm more Agikuyu now than I ever was in Kenya. Now I know more about myself and my people now. When I finished graduate school, instead of going to do my PhD, I decided to make my own PhD. So I got a job as a security guard where I was just being paid to sit down and read. And I read for 4 years. For 4 years, I was reading. So I really had a chance to read a lot of stuff about all the books written about Kenya and my people that I could find or whatever. So now talking to my dad was a big class. And I probably had more respect for him and my people, because he helped me put everything in context. Why are we suffering? Why are certain things not going so well? Why are we having certain challenges in Kenya? All that kind of. So he put personal experience and he put me in context. He contextualized my own activism.
What does he think about what you're doing?
My father was very supportive, because, you know, having done time and being involved in it, you know, he felt like we can do more and we are not doing enough. And a lot of them, after we became independent, we became complacent. So he was definitely very supportive of that. So in that, I think I have his blessings, and I see my work as just an extension of what he did. And we never had any difference between my father, which is very, we never had any differences between me and my father. Growing up, we never argued, whatever. We were very good friends, because he was very patient. So he taught me a lot of patience. So I think that's more than anything else. That's what I can say. So my father was patient. Sometimes I'll go to my father very angry about something that he said, calm down. And then he said, I said, like, why is my dad angry? I thought he'd be, somebody did this to his son, he'll be angry too. He said, okay, sit down. He's and he'll play down. So now as I grow old, I can understand that you have to be patient, because you too have done a lot of wrong to others. So please be patient with others and let's work on something where we can be more understanding.
You know, you talked about getting back to traditional methods and getting some ownership and control over your own lives.
Yes.
This would lead to real independence. One of the central tensions that I detected in Kenya was this difference between being a Kenyan. People insisted that all of these tribal differences that have caused us so much pain, they're not important. I'm not Kikuyu. I'm not... But I'm a Kenyan.
Yes.
And on the other hand, a real a sense of loss. If we lose these traditions, we lose everything.
Yes.
Is there something in this tension that you sort of work with?
Oh yeah.
To try to bring back some of these methods.
Yes. Number one, that's why I love food so much, for so many reasons. But what now I can add a new one is that when you cook for people, you soften. That food is the only one thing I know softens people than anything else. If I cook for people, even people who are a little quiet and the food was good, then they talk a little bit more and then, you know, whatever. So that's a very important topic that you brought. And if I didn't say anything else, I think that's something I'd like to address. That notion that I'm not a Kikuyu and I'm not this other or the other one is actually what I term as negative ethnicity. Is a way of denying, and is still a continuation of the path that has led us to being losing ourselves more. Mm-hmm. And actually what I can term even more brainwashing, that people want to go to KFC now because we just think we are these neutral people. We have no context. But for me, I don't have to lose my traditions to be a good, you know, I've actually had any quarrels with other people. I feel like I get along great. And I think Now, that should be the evidence to myself and to others that knowing myself and loving myself makes me more love others, other people more. But when I become neutral, I disappear, I have no context, that's taking the shortcut. Why am I denying myself? Are you telling me for the whole region of Kenya, people got along fairly well when they decided, even that our neighbors are the Maasai. Sometimes we go head on to head, but when we decided we have a peace treaty, when people come and borrow food from each other, trade with food, all that kind of stuff, they decided. So we can get along, even without having to deny that we are.
Well, I think that was one of the things that struck me, was that no one had come to that conclusion. The fact that left to ourselves, yes, what we had done, yes, with our ethnic differences is, yes, developed very local ways of solving our differences.
Yes.
And when we become, as you said, this, yes, kind of neutral or more go to the European model,
yes,
now we have no way to sell short of violence.
Yes,
and so,
yes, yes,
but that's,
yes,
not us. That has never been us,
no,
even
no,
when
no,
we
no.
identified as Luo or Kikuyu or Maasai. So you're now trying to figure out a way to, mm-hmm, use that rootedness,
yes,
and do that. When we come back, I want to take a break right now.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to talk about how we do that here in Durham and,
yes,
then beyond,
yes,
in places in the United States where that message still has not caught on. My guest, Jyothi Kabuyi, who is a catering company, Organics and Sound. It promotes sustainable food in North Carolina, and our conversation will continue in a moment. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacia. My guest today, Jyothi Kabuyi, founder of Organics and Sound, a sustainable food catering company and a community organization. So tell me about this community garden in Durham now.
By the way, we didn't buy the lot.
Stole it?
We still. Yeah. that's what we did. But a lot of thanks to Peter Silka, who runs the organization. Partnership reinvestment partner.
Mm-hmm.
But he had a lot that's really big. Had water tank, had water lines, and so what happened is he sent out an invitation for people to use the lot because he tried to work it as a community garden, didn't work. So a lot of people wanted the lot. It's very ideal. It's very well slanted, whatever. So anyways, we, Organics and Sounds, put in a request, and we did get the lot. So now we are interested in growing food and using this as a physical space because now we don't have a restaurant or whatever. So we just do dinners and we do food issues. But now it's great. And I always wanted to move to Durham, by the way. I got big attraction to Durham.
But so, Apex is the peak of good living.
Yeah, Apex is the peak of good living, but Durham is the peak of good gardening and good relationships. You know, you have to live with friends, and you know, people have to get along, you know, to live. So that's I have no issues with Apex, but I love Durham.
Yeah.
I know whatever, but anyway. So Peter extended this invite is great. We're using it as a pilot program to how we can use vacant lots to create economic development, to uplift, revitalize the community, and how to connect the community. So there are other pieces to the project. He's trying to get a lot across the street. Who knows you too? Peter Silka knows you. He's in your church or whatever. But so we are part of a bigger project. So we want to also use that as a way of connecting Kenyans here. I haven't seen anything. Oh, churches maybe that. And churches to me sometimes can tend to be kind of segregating in that, mm-hmm, you know, people go to these churches. But how can we have a common ground that we can bring these two, can be the basis of merging these two cultures to where we can mutually coexist to each other's benefit? So we're going to host dinners there from time to time. We're going to have a pavilion so that if the Kenyans or anybody else want to have a space where they can come and, you know, gather for a baby shower or something, can do that outside. And also use that as a lab for teaching. You know, Kenyans need to be interested in to have a place where the kids can come and, right, connect with food.
But now this is, are you talking about the project back in Kenya?
No, here.
In
right
Gear
here,
Street?
Right here, yeah, Gear Street, yes.
So you're bringing the Kenyan community in
here
this region?
Yeah, and African-American, all everybody.
And you're teaching as well. We actually caught you in the process of teaching farming over at Gear Street.
So you start on one side, I start on the other side, and this is how even in Africa we work in unison. And that's how we got our rhythm. So even when we sing in accordance. Because there's a rhythm in everything. Yes, there is a rhythm in work. So And the thing about this, it was also psychological. Nobody could take a break out of, you know, because, you know, if you take a break, you're really holding me up. But so it really kind of forces you to kind of stay on task and not get distracted.
So you're putting the community back in community garden.
Indeed, indeed, indeed. And so it's interesting. You called that Lindsay. I called that. You think about how connecting to the food, even some of the few people who have volunteered, and we had great response from the community. But talking about sounds and organics and sounds, look at the sound that of the conversation that is amazing. People come and they talk about relationships. They talk about food. They talk about their work, their stress, all kinds of, you never know what comes up. And then, and the good thing I really love about that is most people are not in a hurry because we are being productive. So people are very patient when they are doing work. So we are having fun. We are doing something really productive, a very great act of civil obedience, and growing our own food, and you know, something for good and for a good cause. And there's no money involved. No money is changing hand in the community. So we're just working, you know, people volunteering, but yet for a bigger cause. Although we might end up selling the food or doing the dinners.
Well, I was going to say, where does the food go?
Okay, three places. We're going to donate some of the food, and we're going to eat some of the food, and then we're going to do the dinners with some of the food. And then as people who work come and volunteer when we start harvesting, then they take some food with them.
And some of the things that happen at these dinners, too, we should talk about what they are. I mean, sometimes it's a dinner party. Somebody
yes.
wants to throw a dinner party.
Yes.
But other times you have nonprofits or basically fundraisers
yes,
where
yes.
somebody wants to do that in their home, and they might
yes.
charge a little bit.
Yes.
You come and cook, and then the money goes to a nonprofit or
yes, yeah. So that's why I say food is the most political thing, because I've done things I've never thought I would be doing. But one of the things I'm very passionate about is supporting things. So the way I see myself, organics and sounds, is that we don't try to invent anything. That's why we don't even have a restaurant. For us, I just like to support other work. But because I don't have money, I don't have a lot of money to give a lot of people. So I'm always taking food or that piece of food. So whatever you're doing, how can we add food and it helps you build what you're doing? So for example, Pickard Mountain just called me a week ago. So matter of fact, I spent the day on Thursday just hanging out at Pickard's Mountain. I don't know whether you're familiar with Megan. Megan and Tim are in Chapel Hill. They have 68 acres, and they have Pickard Mountain Eco Institute. I think Tim used to work for Red Hat, and I think they sold it.
And where is it? Where is it?
In Chapel Hill.
Yeah.
In Chapel Hill, the street is Pickard Mountain as mm-hmm. well. So they have an Eco Institute where they are doing the same thing. So they have this big noble project, which I can definitely associate, because they are trying to build a commercial kitchen where locals can come and use it to make jams, whatever, package, whatever. So they are doing a fundraising going on June the 2nd. So they asked if somebody reach out for me. A friend of mine, Tammy Lyle, introduced me to them. So anyway, so they are... They want me to go and do the food for them to do the fundraising. So I've been involved in all this in a small project. So that's how it is. So for me, I'm only taking the highest level of food that I know how to help other projects go. So
tell me about some of these dishes you create.
So my rule is I don't cook from a cookbook, right? So that's something I had to do, so that it forces me to really be creative and listen to my creative energies about how I can recreate food. And it's not Kenyan food. Yes. Some people have helped me understand. I don't cook Kenyan food or African food. I cook food that's the best food we can eat for this time as a confluence of culture. I think sometimes, the reason why I say that, I think sometimes the more I learn, I think we are lost at the cost of acquiring spices or certain foods. You know, for a long time, people are eating very bland food, or whatever. But now, because of the European exploration, Middle East getting away, Columbus, all the efforts of Columbus, all the other people, now we were able to get all kinds of spices. So we should be eating the highest food, right? So I say, of all the things that we've made, we're eating food. Food is the only thing that actually go backwards. I meet a lot of successful Kenyans. They got houses, they got cars, whatever. But they are eating food. Worst food that they ate when they were very, very poor. The poorest they can point to me, they ate better food then. So anyway, so I take the best food so I'm creating dishes for different reasons, for names, for named after some great people in my family, my culture, great events, as a way of keeping our memory. If you look at the Jews, for example, with Passover, they don't eat leavened bread because they didn't have, and I have all kinds of stories that I've found about food. So they don't eat leavened bread because they didn't have enough time for bread to rise. All right, so that they do that every Passover Friday so that they can, in memory of what happened. But I say one of the problems with Africa, with Kenya, I know, for example, is that we are losing memory. I say one misinvestment is one, but memory is another major problem that Kenyans have. So I have to create things that force people to remember.
Well, that's a problem here too as well, don't you think?
Yes.
That we're sort of not remembering what we came from and the importance of food. Is it different in this country though? Because the question I always come to in this discussion about sustainable food in particular and high quality food is it's come to a point where only a privileged few or those of us who are privileged can really afford to eat the best produced food because the other stuff's just a lot cheaper. You can go get it at Costco or even Walmart and save a few bucks, and you can't be blamed for doing that if you're on a budget.
Again, that's why food is political, because if you have a lot of money, you can buy justice in this country. You can buy political influence in this country. You can buy anything. So the same thing with food. That's why food now become politicized. And I think it got to be almost the last frontier of this, the oppression of our freedom or the actually arresting our freedom. So food in this country is only a bit different. But I think the only thing that's slightly different, I see more vibrant and more institutionalized groups that are actually doing a lot now to combat that. And we still have a lot of work to do. But I did want to make the distinction between that and Kenya because there are no really strong formal organizations that are national in stature. But here, I belong to North Carolina Farm Stewardship, for example, which is a very, very strong organization. They had 1,000 people at the Sheraton Imperial. Wonderful, wonderful food. They cook local food, by the way. Chef Chris created this menu, whatever. But so those are things that are visual. And that's why I also like Durham. A lot of things are happening. That's the same thing I like to see. And I like to participate in making it more vibrant so that now by what I learned from here, then I can share it with the Kenyans. In my country and as well, Kenya's.
And most of your cooking comes from your actual culinary education, right? I mean, because you made it clear there really wasn't a lot of that kind of cooking in your tradition and your upbringing. So are you bringing much of your traditional cooking experience to this?
Yes. Yes. The cooking style, you know, I'm learning about now. The culinary school helped me in the biggest way in opening more ingredients. But the cooking style, I try to stay true to my cooking style, to my heritage. In that one, creativity, and not always being held. I got it off. I don't know what. So staying true to the creativity.
Yeah.
And flavor. My dad always cooked backwards. You know, say teach you how to cook backwards. You take a flavor, then you have the way, then you cook backwards.
Wait, your dad cooked?
Oh, my dad was the best cook in the family.
Uh-huh.
So when my brothers, when they wanted to go in the evening, people finish their work, they'll go out in the evening, you know, hang out with their friends, right? If they knew my dad was cooking, all my brothers would change their plans. Say, we're not leaving. We're staying around. We're staying put. So my dad was a great cook.
Wow. Was that a cultural norm, or was he breaking some rules?
No. It was not cultural norm because men didn't cook. So yeah. You see, that's I can see again. Men didn't cook a lot. So, but my dad, and he cooked rarely. In fact, it was a funny thing. My dad would, when he was in a house, he didn't want to stay in the kitchen because him and my mother would start arguing because I would tell my mother, why are you doing this? And my mother would tell me, when you're cooking, I don't say anything. So when you have cooking, don't say anything. So my dad was away.
Is that why he opened the restaurant?
That's
I mean, there could be good business reasons
It could be, but sometimes, you know, people tend to do what they like.
Yeah.
So I know he understood food in a way that I haven't found most people. And connection to growing it and flavor, you know, how to mix it and that kind of stuff.
And you travel around the country, around this country as well.
Oh, yes. Just came from Memphis where I did an event in Memphis for a great group called Eatables and other events. That's the one who flew me down there. I'll be speaking at in Madison at a Vegan Fest, Mad City Vegan Fest in June. So I'm going all might be going to Finland here in a while, going to Senegal. So a lot of invitations coming up, and also awards too, which is amazing. I got awarded by the Kenyan community. The ambassador gave me an award for bringing organic and community gardening, because you know, I also work with people to help them have community backyard gardens rather.
And you've done that. You are doing that in Kenya. Talk about the project that you've got going in Kenya.
So when I went to Kenya, I'm interested in having a small eco-institute. So I have this idea that all these great ideas I'm learning here in North Carolina, they have to have a vehicle. You know, I can't share. Sometimes I talk on radio. There's a radio station that calls me in Kenya that actually wanted you to speak, but it didn't work out. But anyway, so... that's not enough. Talking on radio is not enough. We as human beings respond very well to things that we can see. So I want to create some space in Kenya where people can come and actually learn most of these things there. You know, I like to have a kitchen or a little anchor institute people where can come and eat. I love to sharing food is a way that can speak a thousand. So when people taste the food, I can explain the flavor to you, you know, especially I have a great weakness in explaining flavor. So I just do mine by letting you taste it. So that's one. We want to have a place where we can grow some organic practices where we can have compost, vermicompost, grow various different kind of fruits, even fruits from here. That we might not necessarily be growing a lot of, like blueberries that are very nutritious, quinoa and all that kind of stuff. But also a space for people to get together around sane ideas and logical ideas. And we can counter some of these ideas that most Kenyans agree that are, you know, the politicians have done a great job of dividing the people for their own benefit. So now, you know, how can we create more spaces and hopefully replicate these all over the East African region or in other communities?
It would be truly subversive and revolutionary if you could bring people together around food and undermine the dominant narrative about division among tribes.
Yes.
Bring them together around foods in those rural areas. That would be a pretty amazing prospect and project. And also the entrepreneurial. I mean, Kenyans are nothing if not entrepreneurial. If there's a good way to figure out businesses around this and a business model, it may come from Kenya to here, it seems to me. And we could learn a lot about how to make this thing economically sustainable.
Yes. Yes, I'm fascinated by, or at least I'm challenged by the fact that America has 35 million acres of lawn, and we're still eating crappy food, you know. Yeah. So that's the first thing, even from an entrepreneurial perspective, is how can we use the land that we already have to improve our health and feel good about ourselves.
Well, you know, lawns are like manicured fingernails. It was a way of showing that the manor had so much wealth that we could actually take this land out of production. It was all designed to produce and engender envy.
Oh, really?
That's the history.
I didn't know that. Yeah. Matter of fact, we had manicure in my culture too, where people would keep long nails,
which meant that they didn't have to work.
They didn't have to work.
So that was another.
So there's a lot of parallels. That's why working in Kenya, working here, to me is just the same. Two sides of the same coin.
We're happy to have you here, and Chef Kabui, so good to talk with you.
Thank you very much.
Jathi Kabui, a farmer, a chef, founder of Organics and Sounds, a sustainable food catering company. For more information, you can visit organicsandsounds.com. That is with an S at the end, right?
Yes, Organics and Sounds.
For both. And this is The State of Things with an S at the end. Thanks for listening. You can go to our website, stateofthings.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.